session number 23362, Reel 1.
Elaine Cheverton, Reel 1. If I could ask you, first of all, Elaine, to tell me something about your background, whereabouts you were born and brought up.
My father was in the First World War, and at the end of the war they were recruiting for people to join the Indian Army, and he thought this would be a good thing to do. At the end of the war he got married, and they went out to India. My mother had to wait until they had accommodation in India. And then she came home to have me in Birmingham with her in-laws in Birmingham. And then I went out to India at 2 months old, and was there. The army got long leave once every 4 years and to come home. And then we used to go around the relatives and things. And then I was left in England at seven, because of course in those days there weren't army schools, there wasn't any facilities for educating. The army was not all that keen on the families anyway, so they were a nuisance, and having to provide facilities for families was not one of their priorities. So I was left with, I was basically boarded out really, in Hastings. And I didn't see my parents from seven until ten and a half. So, and I used to go to my aunt, one of my aunts or my grandparents for the school holidays. And
how did you adapt to that? You know, what was? Did you have brothers and sisters?
No, I had a brother, but 14 years younger. So it was basically I was an only child.
Was it quite a shock? You know, leaving your parents at the age of seven.
Yes, because one was always, I think I felt always on sufferance. It was always be sure that you aren't a naughty girl when you're with granny, because she won't have you again, kind of thing. The anxiety of parents who are leaving their child and, you know, hoping that all will go well. So one always sort of felt, I mean, I think it stood me in good stead, because I got so used to living in different houses and different homes and adjusting to different people, that it was one got quite adept at seeing what would be acceptable and what was good behaviour in one granny's house was not in the other, you know. So one became adaptable. Mm-hmm. And then my father was due on long leave when I was ten and a half. His father there was a brother, my father's brother, who was a doctor in Cyprus in the colonial medical service, and the brothers hadn't seen each other for a very long time. So it was arranged that I would go out with my grandfather to Cyprus, and that my mother would come from India. My father at the time, sorry if this sounds a bit complicated, my father was on the northwest frontier at the time, so it was it made sense for my mother to come to Cyprus, you know, at the beginning of the year, and have several months there before my father could join her. So I went out with my grandfather and was in Cyprus, and learnt to ride and didn't have any schooling. thoroughly enjoyed life. And then they came home on long leave, and then I went, and then they went back to India. And it was a terrible, for my mother particularly, it was a terrible struggle really. She was either with her husband or with her child. I mean, she came back in between time, but not on that particular occasion. She came back later. And in those days, it was, what, 3.5 weeks by boat? And then no sort of telephone or air thing. You know, letters took a month. And she used to write every week, and I used to write from when I was 11. I then went to boarding school in Charlotte Bronte's old school, Casterton, up in Westmorland. And I used to spend my holidays with, as before, with either my aunt or my grandparents.
You didn't go back to India for holidays at all?
No, because, I mean, it was expensive and it was a long, you know, 3.5 weeks journey each way, and that was only getting you to Bombay probably, and you then had several thousand miles to get to Quetta or wherever.
Yes, it's interesting you saying about the Indian army, that they didn't do much for families. There wasn't a lot in the way of support. Is that right?
Well, I think it was seen as a distraction. You know, the men were there there was the Northwest Frontier Provinces, the fighting going on. There were various, you know, incidents and things, and I think the army didn't want to have. There was a security bit when my father was on the frontier. The wives and the other officers, the wives would be put into a hotel because the army didn't want to be responsible for a wife and children in a bungalow for the security and all the rest of it. So I don't think they set out to be punitive, but it was one of their, you know, we'd better do something about it, but it was not, I mean, the thinking in the doctors, there was a woman who took her baby aged about two or three months old, had diarrhea and vomiting, and took it to the doctor, the army doctor. He said, "Well, I should take it off all solids for 2 weeks." That was the sort of, because they were army doctors, they were there to deal with wounds and, you know, illnesses for the men. That's why they joined the army. They didn't want to be GPs. But they didn't know anything very much about. Looking after us was, you know, they did the minimum. And so I think probably from that point of view, having to give people what was virtually 6 months, you see, you had travelling time off and you had 4 months. They had 4 months in England or wherever they wanted to take it.
Did you miss India when you came to school at the age of 7? You know, I wonder what your life had been like in India.
Well, it was funny because I was bilingual. In fact, the first two words I ever said, because there was the sort of custom that you spoke Urdu to the servants rather than the child picking up a Chichi accent, you see. So I spoke more Urdu than I did English, and my first two words were, there used to be an army band went at the bottom of the road, which was Baja, and Dude, which was milk, and my first two words were Dude and Baja. And you would have thought that with all that there, it wouldn't go, but I've lost it within 6 months. And when I went out to India again, I had to learn all over again. It's surprising. I understand that up to the age of 7, that's what happens, you lose it. But it was a kind of life that one took for granted. If you wanted a lemonade, you just shouted and one of the servants brought you a lemonade. You didn't have to worry about, you know, doing the washing or as far as everybody had sort of, you know, five or six servants. There would be the boy who waited at table, there would be the ayah who looked after the child, there would be the gardener and the head man who sort of ran the thing, and all that as far as meals were concerned, it was the kitchen would be a separate outhouse place with a cook, and you would tell him what the menu was for the day. You wouldn't be going into a hot place and cooking yourself, you know. So that it was a sort of life where, I suppose, as a child, you accepted the fact that there was always somebody there to do things for you or go places with you or whatever. And adjusting to an English way of life, an English climate, was probably pretty difficult.
How about your friends? Would they have been also army children? Your young friends?
Yes. Yes, I mean, there was a thing, you see, you'd have an ayah, and the ayah would take you to some mem sahib's house where their children were, and they played there and stayed there for lunch or whatever, you know.
Well, what area were you living in India?
Well, my father was posted to all over the place. There was Quetta, which was on the frontier. There was Peshawar, Faizabad, Lucknow, mostly the northwest provinces. But when I went out to India when I was 19, they were actually in South India, in Secunderabad. And my mother said that within 28 years of living in India, there were only two houses that she was in for more than a year. And you had, you had the heavy furniture. Everybody had their own, you know, china glass, coffee tables, and so on. But when you moved to another station, there were furniture contractors who did the beds and the tables and chairs and things. So you just hired them from it was all very much the same. You just hired them from a furniture contractor. But things like the curtains, because most of the bungalows were fairly, at least as I remember it, fairly similar. So you took your curtains with you and you had them lengthened or shortened by the Dersey, the tailor who came and sat cross-legged on the veranda and made clothes for you. There weren't shops.
I suppose you would have seen lots of different animals, would you, in India? Would it have been a very different environment?
Yes, funnily enough, one didn't see very much of the sort of wilder animals. There were all, one became absolutely, you know, that you keyed into the fact that you didn't put on your shoes until you tipped them up in case there was a scorpion, and you looked out for snakes, particularly in the bathroom where they liked the dampness, because you just had a tin tub and hot water, sloshed water around. And there were all the sort of bizarre animals, the camels and the donkeys and the oxen and the horses. Watched polo in the afternoons and things, in the evenings, things like that. It was a very strange, exclusive life to each group. There was the ICS, the Indian Civil Service, were the top of the list, and they were the magistrates and so on. And then there was the army, and it was and then there were the boxwallers, as they call them, the business people. And each group kept very much themselves and had their own rules of behaviour. I can remember the great thing was, I don't remember the details, but that everybody, you took round your visiting card, and when somebody had arrived new, you took round a visiting card from both. For some reason, the women's visiting cards were larger than the men's visiting cards. And if you were leaving a visiting card just to show, you know, somebody new came in, you left a visiting card as sort of, you left a visiting card and not, didn't sort of knock on the door and say, hello, can I give you some tea or anything like that? You just left a formal visiting card. You turned down the corner. If the car, I can't remember now whether it was, if the husband was away, to indicate some detail, just turning down the corner of the visiting card. And it was all very strict with how many weeks you, within how many weeks you had to call and had to return the card, you know, then the new people would then come and, having had your card, it was all right for them to come and leave you their card. So it's a strange world, isn't it? And another custom was that when a newly married bride came out, for the first 6 months, she led the people into the dining room at dinner parties. Instead of the in the normal way, it would be the most, very strict precedence. In the normal way, it would be the most senior woman, the wife of the most senior man there. And you went in two by two, and you know, it was a whole precedence thing, and sort of the sort of youngest ones or the least influential ones trailed in last. But for a bride, for the first 6 months, she always went in first. I thought it must be agony for a new bride coming out, trying to get to know India and the customs and things, to be this sort of thing, you know, to, and all very formal, and the ladies going off at the end of dinner, leaving the men to have their cigars and port, and it was all.
Did you have big garden parties? One imagines, you know, the days of the Raj with lovely garden parties for these.
I think the senior people did. The resident or the governor or whatever used to have, yes, formal garden parties. But mostly, again, there was a sort of fairly set routine that there was always a club, and they would have dancing and dinners on a Saturday night. Everybody would, people would have a dinner party in their own home or at the club, and then they would be dancing and go on till about 2 a.m. And everybody did this every weekend. It was a sort of thing. And there'd be a swimming pool or something, and people would go on a Sunday morning and have a gin and tonic and swim.
Was there much interaction with the Indians themselves?
On the whole, no. When we were in Secunderabad, as part of Hyderabad Deccan, and that was a very much a group of high class, mostly, I was trying to think, was it Muslim or Hindu? Mostly Muslim, I think. And they'd been, most of them had been educated in England, and, you know, and play bridge and invite each other to dinner, but that was a bit unusual. Otherwise, no. I mean, the wives of somebody commanding a regiment or unit, where probably all the Indian troops' wives would be in purdah, and then the commanding officer's wife would go and visit them and talk to them. I mean, a good one would, sometimes people didn't, but they would feel the responsibility for going and seeing them and seeing that they were all right and so on, and having, you know, tea with them. But it was a paternalistic kind of setup, really. Didn't. It was very narrow and rigid. The things that you could do and couldn't do.
Mm. There, of course, has been a lot of interest in the sort of Raj period, hasn't there?
Yes.
Do you find books and the sort of plays about it approximate to what you remember?
Yes. I was thinking of all the ones written by one of the...
The Scott books, would it
Viceroy's wives. Oh, what was it? I can't remember the name of it. But yes, it was very reminiscent.
In England, you know, at your boarding school, would you have been with other girls with Indian parents serving in India?
No, I think I was the only one there. It was actually a clergy daughter's school. I was a clergy granddaughter, but and they were mostly clergy children. I don't remember there anybody else being in the same situation. There must have been a few, because when it was half term and people went back to their families for a half term, there would always be about... I don't remember anyone from the army, but there were probably five or six of us who didn't have anybody to take us out to go home to, and the school would put on picnic or trip into Windermere or somewhere like that.
So were you happy enough at school, do you think, looking back?
I was very happy, because it was children. I mean, I was living as an only child, mixing with my grandparents and their background, and it was delightful to me to have children, people of my own age. And luckily I didn't find the schoolwork difficult. You know, it was really what I used to, going back to school, be glad to go back to school after the holidays, because it was and I got asked out to people to meet, you know, somebody at a school half term would invite me to tea or to stay for the night or something like that. You know, it would all have to be agreed with the headmistress and so on. So I enjoyed that.
So as the 30s were progressing, were you aware of, you know, the events looming in Europe at all? Did these impinge on you? The rise of Hitler, you know, and the Spanish Civil War. Would this have meant much?
I think we knew about it. I don't think... and I know I went through a patch of being very frightened of the war starting out, but that was... I don't know that it was... you kept these things from the children, you know? So I don't think... I left school at 18 and went and did a secretarial course in London. And there was the threatened war in 1938, and of course my mother's sister's husband worked in the bank in Woolwich, the Arsenal, and they had a house in Eltham, and my parents cabled them to send me out, to get me on a boat and send me out to India. Well, that was 1938, and that was impossible. And I was sort of evacuated to friends down in Dorset. And then the peace, as such as it was, came. And then I went and did a secretarial course continued with the secretarial course in London. And I lived at the Girls' Friendly Society hostel in Earl's Court. And that was fun. We used to go to ice skating and things. You know, it was quite a nice group of people.
Mm-hmm. What sort of work were you hoping to get? You know, I was wondering what the opportunities would have been at that time.
Well, I knew I was going out to India. My father was due home in 1939 on long. My parents on long leave. and that I would be going back with them. So there wasn't any sort of feeling that I would need to be using it, but it was just a good thing to learn. I can still do my shorthand. Stays with you like riding a bicycle.
Not Urdu, but shorthand.
Yes, that's right. So they came on leave and rented a house, a summer house, a house for the summer down in Charmouth in Dorset. And then the war was obviously blowing up again, the threat of war. And my father was recalled early. They were all recalled early in August of 39.
That was back to India, was it?
Back to India, yes. And we were all booked to go out. I think it was at the end of October, beginning of November. My brother, in the meantime, had been born and was aged 5. And all that was cancelled because they were going to keep the ships for, you know, wounded and army were being used as part. And then because of the phony war, nothing very much happened. I'd joined the land army and was waiting to be called up for the land army. And I joined the land army in 1938. And then my mother heard from the shipping company that there was a ship now going, and if we wanted to go out to India, there would be one going at the end of November, I think it was, something like that. So I said to I was just 19 when war broke out. So I was on the 20th of September, and the war broke out on the 3rd. So I sort of more or less said to my mother, well, bye-bye, off you go, I'll stay and keep England safe by my land army work. And she said, no, I'm not going to have that. The war might last for years and we're not going to be separated and you come out. I was very irritated about that. I'd have been far happier in the land army. And that was a bit of a dicey journey because it was in convoy. There were 20 ships. And it was, blackout and people for the first few days going to sleep in their clothes in case they were torpedoed. And
can you remember which route you would have taken, roughly?
Yeah, we went. We didn't go through the Suez Canal, I don't think. Or must we? We could have, must have done. I know we arrived in. We must have gone down the Suez Canal, yes, we must have gone down the Suez Canal. But we had to go very, very slowly because we had some small ships in the convoy, and, you know, not passenger ships, but freight ships.
Who was on the ship? You know, was it a very crowded?
They were nearly all wives of people who'd been recalled early. It was quite crowded. And everybody was very anxious, and they were anxious leaving their families back in England and wondering what was going to happen to them. But then when you got out to India, you see, they weren't calling it the war, they were calling it the present state of emergency. You know, there had been a notice in the club, due to the present state of emergency, the ration of whiskey is going to be rationed to X bottles a month or something, and they all felt terribly badly done by. Then, of course, particularly with Japan coming into the war.
Is when you returned to India, what part were you in?
In Secunderabad.
In?
Secunderabad, which is in near Hyderabad in the Deccan. It was an army station. And
what was it like being back in India? Do you remember the impressions?
Well, I then got a job in the army headquarters because they were beginning to be needing men for their other duties, and so much against their experience, they I got a job working at the headquarters, but that was the only sort of interesting